Today is Thursday, October 6, 2022. This is part 3 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Alan spells his name A-L-L-E-N-M-A-L-M-Q-U-I-S-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Alan. How are you today?
Good morning. I'm just doing very well, thanks.
Good. Glad to hear it. Alan, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yeah.
Thank you. We left off last time in 1963 with some pretty amazing hiking you were doing in Grand Canyon by yourself with your 8x10 camera. And you mentioned you'd hike to Phantom Ranch and back to the rim, and you'd hike to Havasu and back to the rim. Where did you go from there?
Okay, the next couple trips were a continuation out there on what, you know, the Western Grand Canyon was technically Hualapai Indian Reservation. I saw very, very few signs of any Hualapais utilizing their land well, it starts. But I came out of Havasu and next went to Peach Springs, which was the only town on the Havasu Reservation, and through the tribe got a hiking permit. I want to emphasize that even back then, even though I don't recall, but I doubt if it was more than $1 a day, but I did have permits for all of this and told them, you know, where I was going, but there was no, they would just kind of shrug and say, you know, if you want to pay us $1 to walk out in that horrible desert, we'll take it.
So this is the Hualapai Reservation's central town called Peach Spring. Do you remember the individuals you dealt with? Did you get their names at all?
No.
Okay.
No, there's just whoever was in the office and dealt with that kind of thing.
Okay.
It was a very small village. It was on the railroad and had been just a small set. I don't know if there were a couple hundred people there even in that area. Now it's quite a bigger deal. But the next thing I did was I drove, I've got this Ford Fairlane sedan, two-door sedan, packed with camping gear, and I drove down Peach Springs Wash to Diamond Creek.
Okay.
And that was, now that's a major way to get out of river trips, and buses and trucks and trailers go up and down there all the time. When I went down, this was a really little remained of this backcountry road. Fortunately, it was all downhill. It was not bad. But I made it as far as Diamond Creek. And then there you're only a mile or so down to the river. And I camped at Diamond Creek, and the road from there was very rough with big boulders washing down off the Diamond Creek Canyon, and the road had just been washed out constantly. So I walked down from there, and much to my surprise, there was a Jeep down there, which, this was 63, so It was an old Army Jeep from the Vietnam era, and there were two fishermen there, and these were both what we call in northern Arizona in the Indian area Anglos like me, and that's probably the term I would use unless you don't care for it. But
no, that's good.
There were Anglos and Indians, and that was considered, no bad connotations of either. But just to describe, who was down there were these two guys who were in, late 20s or so. They're fishermen. And the part that it just dismays me no end in later years, I talked to them and they, how are you doing? I was surprised to see them there. And yes, they were, hoping that some of the bass or trout would come up from, from Lake Mead, which was quite a ways downstream. But they said, come and see what we caught. We don't know what they are, but they're sure interesting, and they're big, and we've left them in a pool here. They're still hooked, or they had them on a leader, 2 liters, actually, big ropes. And it turned out that they were the Colorado River, at the time was called the Squawfish, and in later years it became, that name was dropped and more to the Colorado white minnow. But these were two fish that looked like salmon, that shape, sleek, and they were at least 6 feet long.
Wow.
Giant, and that's what the huge effort the last 20 years has been, to preserve the various native fish to the Colorado in the Grand Canyon and other places. Just millions and millions of dollars have been spent to try and preserve these very endangered fish. And
so
my problem was I didn't take a picture.
Oh.
Can you believe it? and they held them up, and it was, the fish was bigger than the guy holding it.
So let me make sure, humpback chub, I don't think chub grow that big, but the pike minnow do. And
yeah,
and so the pike minnow that they were catching, theory, in 1963, those fish could have been adults that found themselves on the wrong side of the Hoover Dam in the 1930s.
Yeah.
And were well into maturity as adults.
Yeah.
The last of the pike minnow being fished out of the river.
Right.
Wow.
Because they, in later years, when I worked up at Lee's Ferry and doing the history, the pioneers there in the 1880s. They mentioned that they would catch these giant fish out of the Colorado.
Right.
And they ate them.
Right.
And they were so big that they would lay one of them over the saddle horn and take it back to the ranch. But this huge fish was hanging on both sides of their lap on the horse, hanging down almost to the ground.
Giant, wow.
Giant fish.
Huh.
But I just, in the later years, that was the one great regret I had, was how stupid was I for not to take a picture of it.
Wow.
I had a 35 millimeter, and I just didn't take pictures of people, I guess. I was kind of shy, and I talked to them, and really was interested, but I had never seen such a thing. I had no idea there were fish like that in the Colorado. So well, that's just an interesting side effect.
It's funny.
The guys, you know, turned them loose in the river.
Oh, did they turn them loose?
Yeah, I think they did later. They said they weren't, you know, they didn't want them.
Oh, wow.
They were fishing for something else.
Right. Huh. That's amazing. You know, this is sort of the fish story of the fish that got away. But in this case, the fish were led to go away, and you didn't get a picture of them.
Right. You know, and here I was, that was my thing with taking pictures, but I guess I didn't want to hike all the way up to the, you know, the mile back to the car and where my camera gear was and load up the backpack and bring it down.
Bring it back, huh?
But, and I just, honestly, I was surprised that I didn't think, like, oh, well, I wasn't a fisherman, so I just didn't appreciate I definitely didn't appreciate the situation.
Wow. Yeah. Interesting. Huh.
But they when you hear the stories, those big fish did exist.
Yeah.
Because they caught two of them.
Amazing. Amazing. I mean, there would have been some of the last squat fish there. Pike
yeah.
Now. Yeah. Wow. My.
Okay, so let me continue. I got down to the mouth of Diamond Creek, camped there for 3 or 4 nights, and day hiked. I went up Diamond Creek through the Narrows and up to where it comes out of Springs. It was interesting, but I don't recall taking a picture.
Okay.
What I did do was I hiked up the Colorado at the mouth of Diamond Creek. I could notice that there was kind of a set of what then were wild burro trails that made their way up onto the rim of the canyon there. That maybe
onto the top of the Tapetes?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it wasn't that far, that high, because I carried our stuff, and I ended up hiking probably 5 miles up on those levels of the Tapetes there.
Great.
And took, it turned out, one really, really great picture that in later years was on the cover of the Sierra Club Bulletin in March of 68.
Nice.
And we'll get to that whole Sierra Club stuff later. But this is where I was doing the work that I couldn't quite figure out what I was doing or if this was going to turn into anything. But I kept taking pictures. But we'll come back to those later. And the next thing I did was I went further west along the south rim through the Hualapai lands. And the next goal was to see if I could get down into Bridge Canyon, because I had this little map from the Bureau of Reclamation and the USGS map that had been published of just that area. And I went out there and I found the trail that went down. It was kind of overgrown and all, but it switched back down, typically down a fault zone to get over the red wall and then out on this big amphitheater-like affair, and went on down and there was, you couldn't, or at least I couldn't go down the main ridge canyon because it kind of cliffed up there and some drop-offs that I didn't feel comfortable with. But the trail continued on the left side of the inner gorge of Bridge Canyon, and then there was a place where the trail went down, and there was a beautiful little stream there and a lush oasis. And it was, oh, not even a quarter mile to the river and back. The river was not very interesting there because you had the tamarisk groves and the mud, and I came back up to the beautiful little oasis.
That little oasis, it's got a little kind of slick rock there, and the bridge, the Bridge Canyon cobble bridge, is just right in that area, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I went down to see, and I had no idea what to expect. Mm. It's one of those cobble, like you say, cobblestone bridges where at some point in the past the big flood came down and deposited, you know, maybe 40 or 50 feet of sand and gravel and mud and cobbles. And then over the years, it would be caliche solidified that gravel bed, made them very hard enough that the creek in later years eroded away and actually cut through under it, leaving that little bridge there. You've been to it?
Yes.
Yeah. It's very similar to the one up in Pepitz Creek up into the main park.
Is that tuck up you're thinking of?
Pardon?
Is that tuck up you're thinking of? Yes.
Right. So, but the little, you know, that it was the place, the oasis was fantastic. The bridge was curious. It was interesting, but it was certainly nothing to take a picture of. So. But then I went back up onto the trail that was going down to towards the dam site on the Colorado.
It was
labeled to Bridge Canyon City. I had forgotten that, but I looked up.
It was labeled on the map, or there was actually a sign on the trail?
Labeled on the map.
Okay.
Bridge Canyon City.
Right.
And it was had been a mine and maybe three or four buildings. There was little left, you could, and all of that, but it was an access to the Colorado on the, coming down, getting down the cliffs of the inner gorge there. And I had one experience there that I still remember, and it was, I was out there to learn how to survive in the desert. This again was summer. This was June this was still June.
Oh, wow.
And out there in the daytime, and my little canteen, which you asked about last time. And this trip, this day that I had all my gear and everything and marching along, the sunset before I got to Bridge Canyon City, and I was out of water. And, I didn't really feel threatened like this was a total emergency, but what I did was just left my pack and all the gear up on the trail because I had found where the route went down, so I took my canteen and hiked down to the river, a couple hundred feet down there, and drank and drank and drank and filled up my canteen, and then scrambled back up the old trail to where my gear was and basically camped on the trail without any problem. But it made the very strong message to me to, it's not fun to run out of water in the desert. I'll just put it like that.
So where you went down to the river, was that at Bridge City, where there was a cable strung across a small little canyon there? There was a spring actually on the slope. The trail goes past a little spring, and then down to the river. There's a flat area where there were some cabins. This was all to support the drilling and dam exploration done in 1940, 1941, or 1942.
Okay, I never went to that site.
Okay.
I never went down to the river there.
Okay.
Or that I knew. I didn't know that could have been, redeveloped a little for that very reason, for the dam surveyors. But I didn't see a cable. There was definitely not a spring right there. It was
okay.
Just the river.
Okay.
And there was, a lot I didn't know, because all those histories were not readily available.
Right. Got it.
Yeah. Anything I found out about it would have been what I talked to and people and everything. When I came out back to the car at the top of Bridge Canyon up there, I did take a picture down from there, and I was very disappointed with it because the weather was, it was overcast, it was dreary. To me, the picture was just a gray blob, but it turned out in the long run that was the only picture available to the Sierra Club of the Bridge Canyon when it was such an issue and it was published.
Okay.
And it turned out okay when it was published by the Sierra Club. But then I drove further west and went down Marowetica and over to Spencer Canyon.
Okay.
And found both of those really fascinating. And again, there were old trails there.
Yes.
They'd be, again, going down a fault that disrupted the layers enough that a trail could be built. And these were not fancy CCC trails. They were trails of use and trails that at the time there were still a lot of wild burros down in there. I remember Marowetica, there was quite a 15 or 20 burros that were very interested in me. They ran up, looked at me, I talked to them, they brayed back, and then they followed me around till I, was moving into the next drainage, and then turned around and went back where they wanted to go.
Wow.
So I was thankful, actually, to the burros to keep the trails open.
Right. But that's really fascinating that they ran to you.
Yeah.
And the last time I encountered burros in there, they ran away from me. I mean, they would see me from a eighth of a mile away, and they would bray and run. Now, there was a mountain lion in that same area that same day, so I wonder if they knew the lion was there, which is very possible.
And then in later years, the Park Service and the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the BLM, were really trying to deal with the overpopulation of burros.
Right.
And they had had rounded up by helicopter and moved here and there. And I think by the time you were there, they may have been harassed enough that they took off.
Absolutely. Good point.
But I went and there was a big spring coming out of the Red Wall into Narrowetica. And then I went. Spencer turned out to be a beautiful, beautiful canyon. A broad bottom with a nice stream, cottonwoods along the whole thing. And until you got down close to the river, where again you had the mudflats and especially the tamarisk thickets, where it was difficult to get to the river at the mouth of any of those canyons.
Right. Well, it would have been a lake at that time, a reservoir.
Yeah. Right. It was reservoir out there, but it, sometimes during the year it was lower than others, so there were. And this was before the summer runoff, so with the higher water in the rivers, I think there was more mudflats than high water for me.
Okay. Alan, I want to ask you, did you see any signs of beaver in Spencer Canyon?
No. That's interesting, but I did not.
Okay.
I didn't. I've seen lots of beaver up above, in Lee Ferry area,
mm-hmm.
the Glen Canyon Dam. But I knew they were in the river.
Okay. Just checking. So did you get your pack all the way down? Or did you leave your pack and then try to day hike down to the reservoir, to the water at the river? Or did you bring your pack with?
These were the Marowetica and Spencer. That was at least a 3-day pack with everything. And I camped up on the stream a mile or two above the river, and I left my stuff there and just walked down to see if I could get out of the mouth of the canyon.
I see.
I realized that was a very, down there was very different than up at Bright Angel Creek.
Yes.
And it made the point to me of how you didn't want to flood anymore as a canyon. It was really bad. And then I'm thinking from there I went over east of the Grand Canyon along 89 and stopped at Wupatki, just north of Flagstaff.
Okay.
And I got to know a couple of the rangers there really well and ended up camping there for about a month.
Oh, my.
And it was actually in the backyards of the ranger houses.
Do you remember their names?
I was thinking of that. One was, the place I put up my tent was at the archaeologist, and he was Morris, the last name. And what was his first name? I can picture him in my mind. He was a park archaeologist and went on and did a lot of archaeology work for the National Park Service in later years.
Okay.
And the other ones that I had, turned out I had a lot more real friendship with was Terry Gustafson.
What can you tell me about Terry, your first recollections and meetings with him?
Did you know him? Or
yes.
Of him? Did you know of him? Or
yes.
Oh, okay.
But not
because,
not that early.
Yeah, okay. Because I came into Wupakee and along the road and at the first big ruin, the Citadel on the mesa to the right, there was a little contact station, which was basically just a wooden box that two people would have been uncomfortable in. And the front the kind of like a Dutch door, the top half opened, and there was a kind of a platform there, you could talk to the ranger who was in this little box. There was very little visitation, and Terry definitely answered all my questions and directed me where to go and back and forth, and did several trips around and ended up, like I say, camping there. I'm not sure the sequence. Oh, I probably from the Grand Canyon went to Flagstaff and down to the Oak Creek and camped there. And I know I then camped up at, north side of Flagstaff, there was a commercial campground. Right now, it's where the Maverick gas station is up there.
Okay.
There's still an open area there in the pine trees, but that was the edge of Flagstaff. That was out of town.
Right.
And I camped there, and I went up to Wupakee and several day trips. But then when I got to know them more, they, agreed that I could just camp in the back of his ranger station there.
Nice.
And I spent a good month up there traveling from Wupakee. I saw, back then there was the Antiquities Act was in its infancy, and when they, someone like myself who was really interested into the prehistoric Indians and the ruins, and they'd gone out with me, and I'd gone out with them, and they felt comfortable about telling me where the good stuff was. And I really appreciated that, and I would, took a hike by myself out to the hole in the rock?
Kraken Rock, yes.
Kraken the Rock, yeah. Went out there really like that, and I didn't camp out there, those day hikes.
Okay.
And I found that the geology of Wupakee was as interesting as the prehistoric people with the great earth cracks there.
Mm.
And they have very narrow openings, and they're called blowholes. There's one by the main ruin there where there's just a hole in the bedrock there, maybe 6-8 inches back of wide, and depending on the air pressure, the air is either being sucked into what amounts to a gigantic cavern underneath, and when the air pressure changes, the air just rushes out with it, and you can just feel it. And you drop some dirt, and it just blows up there. And there were three other blowhole sites in the monument, and in later years, they, using some kind of radioactive material, that they could identify somewhere else that these blowholes are connected to other ones north of Flagstaff, and, you know, 40 miles away. And there's a giant cavern under there, but it's just cracks in the rocks that are
earth cracks.
You couldn't get into, but they're sealed off at the top with debris that's come in, and but they function with these huge, blowholes, which I thought was interesting. And I took pictures around there, had fun in that. And then the part I'll mention is that Highway 160 from Cuba City to Kayenta was just paved that winter.
Oh, wow.
And to everyone in Flagstaff and the park around there that tended to be hikers, this was opening up a whole new treasure trove in the southwest corner of Colorado. And every weekend there was a group of hikers, young people my age, that would go up and either backpack for the weekend or car camp and hike and hike and all that area of the San Juan Mountains and the other peaks north of Cortez. And I got really good experience there and a lot of fun too.
So were these people from Stanford that were going out there, or were they local people from Northern Arizona University and Flagstaff, or something else?
I was going with the park rangers there, who come from, all were either in college or the rangers, and summer job at the park, and or they had just gotten their degrees and were working for the Park Service, and they had friends that had friends.
Got it.
Mainly from Flagstaff area. That'd be different people.
So this would be Morris and Gustafson and their circle of friends going out to explore these areas.
Yeah.
Got it.
They were very excited because this, before, it was a big deal to get to Cortez, Colorado area from Flagstaff, mainly dirt roads, well, gravel roads. And now it was just so wonderful. They were very excited, and I was excited to be able to go and see all this new country. But it was a major change in the hiking crew in Flagstaff and north. So, and what was I? I was trying to think what else I was. There was something else I was going to mention. Oh, I went out to the Hopi Mesas one time, and no pictures allowed, but I really took the tours that were available. I thought it was fabulous, the idea of that culture being there for so long and living in the desert so long. And there were about three Hopi guys that worked at Wupakti on maintenance, and that meant just cleaning the area and the visitor center and any road maintenance that needed to be done or anything. And when they found out that I had been there and talked about it, they would just come up on midweek or something and tell me, you know, there's going to be a Kachina dance at such and such village, and you should go and see it. And, you know, told me where and what to do and what not to do. And
nice.
I went, and by the end of the summer, I'd seen 8 Kachina dances, and really it was one of my fondest memories, because most of the time I was either the only or Anglo person, or there'd be, half a dozen that were there, not as tourists, but as just to see the ceremony, which is very important to the Hopi. And I guess I behaved right, because I'm sure the guys that got reports back on who did you send up here. I got along just fine with them, and it would be a day. I'd go up in the morning when, you know, they'd tell me when the first dance probably would happen, and I'd be there and find a place to sit. They have 4 or 5 dances during the day. Kachinas would come out and do their ceremony and then go back in the kiva, and everybody would go back to their houses and visit with their friends and family. And then at a certain time, everybody went back to the plaza, and here came the Kachinas for another performance.
Nice.
I just kind of hung around. They were happy that I didn't. I seemed to be enthusiastic and didn't do anything I shouldn't. And that was really highlighted that whole summer. One of the events that I still, when I think about it, it was something. There were kind of old wooden benches in front of the houses on the plaza, and I've forgotten which pueblo it was in, but I came up and before it got started, and there was a couple people there, and you know, they were friendly, and I kind of pointed to the thing and asked, do you mind if I just sit there, because I really want to see that ceremony and not stand on the back. And oh yeah, that's fine. So I sat there, and then the family piled in, and on one of the dances near the end of the day, all the kids were were being pushed towards the front, so that normally they were kind of playing around in the background seeing their relatives and cousins that they hadn't seen for a while.
Mm-hmm.
They were all kind of, I noticed that they were appearing in the front, and this one little guy who was preschool, maybe 3 or 4 years old, he was obviously his family there, and he looked around and he came over to me and just got in my lap,
mm-hmm.
which was fine, but it was great for me. But I smiled, and the family smiled. They thought this was neat. And at the near the end of the Kachina dance, they all stopped and they spread out around the plaza, and one of them brought fantastic Kachina doll to the little boy sitting in my lap.
Oh my gosh.
So, I was sort of being the right in the whole thing. The boy had this, his eyes were wide open, his mouth open. You know, he knew that the, you know, the respecting the casinos and all, but to have one come over and bring the real casino doll, not the ones made for the tourists.
Right.
Because traditionally they were made to educate the kids. And he was expected to learn that casino, and every, you know, the way it was painted, the marks, the clothing, the boots, the, what he, you know, the animal that he represented, or bird. And I, so at this point, and it was probably his uncle that was there that was responsible for this guy's, you know, religious training. And, but to be there in this, you know, very, well, it was moving.
I bet.
And I still is to me.
Wow. Lovely.
It turned out later that there was the last ceremony of the year was the great Nemon dance that's done. Oh, it was in Hope Villa, which is on the western side of the Mesas. And I went to that, and they had told me, you know, what was going to happen, and to be ready for getting the right position. There were thousands of people. It was almost like the whole tribe, the Hopi people, were all there.
Wow.
And the all the Kachinas from the different Pueblos came, so there were maybe 50. And the Kiva priests and the Kachinas, at the end of the day, the Kachinas lined up, and the priest came along and talked to each of them, you know, probably explaining what the tribe needed, what they would do when they went to the other world, and blew clouds of smoke in their face, which, you know, represented clouds and just all of that. But it was timed perfectly, because when it was done, the whole Katina thing, all of them walked down to the edge of the mesa into the sunset and off the edge, you know, walking down, and the ceremonies for the year were over.
Wow.
And that was, I don't think they'd be too, you know, well, I'm sure they'd welcome some people, but you'd have to know someone there to go to it. But that was, you know, my first trip to Arizona, and had a month in the Grand Canyon, and then this really fabulous experience of with the Hopi, and then photographing around, well, in the whole area.
Nice.
And I went to Keatsio and Navajo Monument, and hiked all those. I packed all my stuff and gear up to Keatsio and camped there for a couple nights. And, you know, I was all by myself. I didn't see anyone on the way in, nobody there for 3 days, and nobody on the way out.
Nice.
And I can also mention that I had heard about Rainbow Bridge, and I, at that time, the only access was by the horse trail. From Navajo Mountain. And I talked to the rangers and everybody, and yeah, you could do that. And so I loaded everything up and drove out to Navajo Mountain, and Have you hiked in that way at all?
No, I have not.
Okay, because the original Rainbow Lodge was still there.
Oh, wow.
It's just ruined now, and the couple that ran it for many, many years was there. They were so happy that I came. And,
do you remember them, the Camerons, Madeline?
Yeah.
What do you remember about them?
That they were just very welcoming, and I wasn't, you know, providing them much income because I was not spending much of anything. And but they were so friendly, and I told me about the trails, what to do, and I trying to think. I did not fax the 8x10 in because, you know, it was summer and they described the huge descent down into the canyon there from the side of Navajo Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
All of that. But I camped at the Echo Camp above the bridge and went down to the bridge. And to my surprise, there were two guys there at the bridge, Angles again, that had hiked up from the river.
Okay.
And that was a long, that was almost as long and hard a hike as I had been done, coming around Navajo Mountain and down the canyon, Bridge Canyon and Cliff Canyon. But they told me that, you know, Glen Canyon Dam had been been closed off. They had the tunnels around the dam site, and the dam wasn't finished, but they started the reservoir about 2 weeks before.
Okay.
And that these guys had gone up in a speedboat to see how far they could get, and they actually got to the mouth of Forbidden Canyon.
Okay.
And then walked upstream the Rainbow Bridge and back. And I guess the next week or two, the word got out that you could boat to a place where you could hike the Rainbow Bridge from Page, and there were lots of people that did it. There, by that, I'd mean maybe 20, 30 people that actually attempted that, because it was difficult in a boat because the water was muddy and it was full of debris coming down the Colorado, and just wherever the reservoir got, it lifted all the driftwood up, floating around, and it was not the most pleasant, but it was exciting to these people that had worked on the dam all these years. And there was a register at Rainbow Bridge.
Okay.
And I think I was like number 300 or 400. It was in the hundreds, definitely, from when that register was first put there by the first river runners or somebody. And or maybe it was put in there by the Camerons from the lodge. But
right.
When I worked at Glen Canyon and the archives there, they had the old registers.
Yes.
And I actually, because I worked from resource management, and the archaeologist had I had keys to the archives, but I asked, you know, can I see those? Because I signed it. And oh, yeah. So I went in there and found the first book, and there it was, that I'd signed it, and the other two guys had signed it. But then I looked the next 2 weeks, and there were all these people that I knew from Page, because we had lived in Page for 10 years by then, and I have no clue that these guys, you know, had been up there just before and just after the same 2 or 3 weeks that I hiked in there. So that was fascinating. Not very important.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to clarify that that register goes back into, I believe, the 1910s and goes through the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s into the early 60s. And there's, you know, there were thousands of people had signed in, but then the register changed. A new register started at, I think, zero again. And Glen Canyon eventually digitized that register.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. I should look that up, because I know my name's in it because I saw it.
Yeah, I can send that to you, but it starts getting, people start complaining about the bridge, or sorry, about the dam, and that register just stops. Then they don't include the later registers. So that's curious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because before, well, I don't know the percentage of river runners that would have come up in the 20s and 30s. I don't know of any then.
It was small, but you could see them. They would, you know, they would say we hiked up from river. And of course,
yeah,
as every decade went by, eventually more river runners came up than people coming in from the rim, from the Rainbow Lodge side. That by the 1950s, there were way more river runners coming up from below than up above.
Yeah. And then they basically stopped for the 4 years that the dam was being built. But there were still some, because...
Oh, yes.
I have to take it back. Now that I think about it, Art Green...
Yep.
From down at Lee's Ferry, he ran his airboat from where you could put in above the Glen Canyon dam site, and he had trips up to Rainbow Bridge. So, but anyway, this is not early Grand Canyon talk.
Right, we're digressing a little bit, but that's okay.
Yeah.
So I got a question for you about that summer of 63 when you spent so much time at Wapaki and went up to Keats Seal and out to the Hopi Reservation. Were the Park Service employees coming out with you on their days off? Or were you basically still solo traveling around?
No, I was solo traveling around midweek, but I tried to... I would have find out, and they went out of their way to let me know who was going where on the weekend.
Oh, nice.
And the other thing, if these were interpretive rangers, Morris was the archaeologist, but Terry Gustafson was what we now would call an interpretive ranger.
Mm-hmm.
They tended to have midweek days off.
Ah.
Would work for weekends. So when I say weekends, I should say days off. So there was a lot of opportunity every week to go somewhere with a group that was happy to have another hiker along.
Nice.
And I've got one more digression, that this is almost the sub-story of the pikefish at Diamond Creek, and why not photographing it.
Hmm.
Over at Sunset Crater, which there was just a really rough gravel road from Wapaki to Sunset Crater, there was another little contact puck. And these things literally, five like 5 feet, maybe 6 by 6 feet.
Wow.
And it opened, like I said, and the ranger was inside and you were outside, but often they'd come out and walk around and show you and talk to you and all. But there was this strange guy who was much stranger than me, much more of a hermit than me, at Sunset Crater. And well, now I've forgotten his name. The ultra conscious writer.
So was this Ed Abbey?
Ed Abbey was there.
Okay.
No kidding. And he was friendly, and you know, I was more or less had the same ideas and feelings and attitudes that he had, and definitely there were very few visitors out there, so he was happy to talk to anyone. He lived in a little old trailer that the park had parked behind a rock, just in the lava flow, not even 50 yards from that contact station. And this was right at the foot of Sunset Crater, where then you could hike up to the top.
Right.
And I did a couple of times and go through the lava beds. But he lived there basically by himself, quite happily doing whatever he did. He was not known for conservation writing yet, because he was an author. I've forgotten what the name of his novel was, that Lonely Are the Brave or something, and it had been made into a Hollywood movie, a Western cowboy movie, and he was getting a little bit, he could have gone on as a Zane Grey of the later, but rather than continue the novels and the cowboy stuff, he did his conservation theme. So the Monkey Wrench Gang was kind of a continuation of that attitude on it. But the funny part is, I was friendly with him. I would stop and talk to him. See where I'd been and what I'd been doing and where I should go and who was going here. And as far as Wupatki, he really wasn't part of the social thing there at the main monument. The superintendent of Wupatki was responsible for Sunset Crater, but he kind of stayed to himself. Didn't come out on any of the hiking, but I have to say I really wasn't too impressed.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, I had other things I was doing, and I was happy, and he was there, but people always ask, well, you knew, you met him, and, well, yeah, I did, but it was what it was.
I'm actually way more interested in Terry Gustafson. Do you have any Terry Gustafson stories around that time?
Let me think, because, yeah, you see, at the end of the summer, he went, and his wife, Rosalind, went back to the U of A. He had one more year.
Right.
And they lived in the married, actually the veteran section, which was the old Polo Village that during the, well, after the war, they had put all these Quonset huts up for returning soldiers who were on the GI Bill and families. And oddly enough, my wife, Sharon's father, and mother, the father went to U of A, and they lived in Polo Village.
Huh.
A couple of years before 63. But I am trying to think all of the things I did with him that was kind of neat. There was a stock pond in the maintenance area that the local Navajos would come and get water, and they actually occasionally watered sheep there, but not very much because they were discouraged from coming up into the monument. But there was this old stock pond that just filled with rainwater, I guess, or one of the springs may have overflowed into it. But Terry was doing a bat banding project for one of his classes.
Oh, wow.
And so every couple nights or some kind of schedule, I know we did it probably 10 times, he had a big mist net on two probably 8-foot poles and stretched it across the stock pond and then basically caught all the bats that were watering there. And there'd be 20 or 30 bats. And with gloves on, you'd go out and get them. And either the most interesting thing would be find that they had been banded somewhere else in Arizona, and they're trying to find out how far these bats moved.
Oh, wow.
And they already knew that they came, they would go down to Mexico and southern Arizona in the winter and come up to Bupaki in the summer.
Right.
But, and then we'd put a band around their ankle and let them go. And I, you know, gladly helped out because that was a neat activity. And you just had leather gloves on and you'd carefully get them out of the nest and take them over to where usually Rosalind was keeping the records, what species and did it have a band or what band was put on it, and they'd go, and we, you know, did that for a long time. All sorts of different bats.
Wow.
That was a project he did for some professor, and because most of the rangers had really got they were not law enforcement at all. They were wildlife managers is what the degrees were.
Right.
And that was one I don't recall too much more other than just having a good time. Evenings, you know, sharing dinners. And if I was going to Flag, I'd pick up stuff for everybody and bring it back with me. And when we went to Tucson, well, I followed, not followed them, I made a trip into New Mexico and Santa Fe and Taos and Bandelier and eventually ended up at Terry Gustafson's Crosses Hut in Tucson. And that was in late 60, fall of 63. Mountains were anticipating snows, but I was not hiking the mountains. I was getting in and out of the canyons up there. And I put up my tent in front of their porch in the Polo Village and just did lots of touring around northern Mexico and southern Arizona.
Oh, wow.
Continued the thing of backpacking where I was appropriate, and sometimes just day hikes from my camp. And then I, and I'm getting, we're probably getting close to where we can.
We are, Alan. I'm wondering if next time we should pick up your stay in Tucson, and you can tell us about going into northern Mexico and exploring that part of southern Arizona.
Right, right. And that would be good because, yeah, see, this is fine. I'm just trying to think ahead too, but it's
right.
Great. It's time
okay.
to stop.
Okay, yeah, yeah, no, it is.
Do the normal routine now.
Yes, exactly. Is there anything else about what we've covered that you want to add?
I'm not right at the moment. I just can't think of it.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, we'll put a comma in this interview series, and this will conclude part 3 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Today is October 6th, 2022. My name is Tom Martin, and Alan, thank you so very much.
Thank you.